Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how vitamin D protects against severe asthma, a study from Queen Mary University in London. We're also going to discuss how obesity, just being overweight, something I've discussed many times on this program, will increase your risk of 13 different types of cancer. And this is from the Center for Disease Control. Also, we're going to explore earlier school start times, increasing the risk of adolescent depression and anxiety. Why? Why getting kids up earlier is now being considered not a good thing? University of Rochester Medical School, and a lot more on health and healing. And then I'm going to continue with what we started yesterday, a very important, brand new, you have not seen it, read it, heard about it anywhere else, a in-depth investigative report of a group of honest journalists who went into East Aleppo, where the terrorists were, and that's where the White Helmets were. And this is the same White Helmet group that was praised and won Academy Award this year, and they received at least $100 million a year, $100 million a year from the United States government. They found a completely different story. They found, for example, that their hospital, when they went inside, was actually a bomb-making ammunitions factory, that they had hidden this from overhead planes, and that they were really just an extension of Al-Qaeda, the terrorist group. And now there's all these witnesses, the people who survived their captivity, telling the truth. The question is, will we learn from this? And I don't believe we'll learn anything from it. I believe that there'll be no apologies from Democracy Now! Or any of the other liberal shows that promoted the regime change in Libya or Syria or the White Helmets. Instead, I'm going to share with you, how did we get to be a nation where we're so controlled by propagandists? This will be one of the most interesting discussions on mind control you've ever heard. And those two will represent part two of White Helmets, the truth of who they are, and then mind controlling the public through the media, which itself is complicit. The back end of our program. So let's begin. Taking vitamin D supplements, in addition to what people normally are using for their asthma, could cut by 50% asthma attacks, including that requiring hospital attendance. That's according to the latest study. Asthma's not good. 300 million people around the world suffer from it, causing over 400,000 deaths every year. And asthma deaths arise primarily due to episodes of acute worsening of symptoms, better known as exacerbations, which are commonly triggered by viral upper respiratory infections. Well, vitamin D is thought to protect against such attacks by boosting immune responses to respiratory viruses and dampening down harmful airway inflammation. The new study, funded by the National Institutes of Health Research and published in The Lancet Respiratory Medicine, took a look at all these people. They looked at 7 randomized controlled trials, and vitamin D, which is actually vitamin D3, was the one that cut the risks of asthma attacks from 30% to 50%. Now, that's just with one nutrient. That does not include, if you were to give them natural vasodilation nutrients, cayenne pepper, for example, and L-carnitine, coenzyme Q10, magnesium. And I've seen people never have an asthma attack after they've been given these supplements. But at least the hard proof is with the vitamin D. I remember once having an obesity group. I wanted to try as a health support group. And it was a massive failure. I had 500 people. That's all that would fit. At that time, I did my studies over on 86th Street at the Jewish Center. They were kind enough to rent me the space, and we seated 500 people, and I had five different groups of 100 each. So one night a week, 100 people would come. And the first group, I gave what you could consider the high-quality diet. There was a very good diet to reduce fat, the excessive caloric intake descriptions, even showing them the kinds of foods, bring in the foods that they could eat that were healthy, showing them a film on power foods, which had been a PBS special I did, or on PBS stations. And the next night, I showed them all the supplements, the vitamins, minerals, herbs that were known to help the body regulate its metabolism. Another night was exercises. We would take them into Central Park and have them power walk. We showed them biking, cross training. We brought in exercise equipment, so they really learned how to get their body in shape. The fourth night, we went into great depth about de-stressing, because people know that stress causes people generally to overeat, and frequently with that comes some depression, and then they lose the desire to be healthy, and they get into this negative feedback loop. So I had about 15 different specialists come in, mindful meditation and yoga, and body-mind relaxation response, trigger point therapy, rebirthing. We handled all that. Really good people. So anything and everything that would cause distress and how to relieve it. And the last group, none of the above. The only thing that I talked about during that entire six-month period was what's missing in your life. If you were to start over and you were to say, okay, I'm juggling all these balls in the air, all these responsibilities, career, family, which of these, if I could start all over again, which of these would I not pick up and start juggling to begin with? And also knowing that we have family responsibilities, cultural responsibilities, religious responsibilities, all these responsibilities that demand of us a certain behavior. Now, that's not a judgment, yes or no, good or bad. It's just, like it or not, one day we wake up and most of our life is just a series of rituals. We go through a day and we do what's expected of us. And we try to do it more often than not as best we can. So if you could start over, which responsibilities would you simply say, not for me? We're not all going to be good parents. Therefore, not everybody should be a parent. That does mean that you couldn't be a guiding light, an emotional support, a motivator, as a big brother, big sister. Plenty of ways that you can interface with children who didn't have parents, who liked them or wanted them, but you could be. So there's always a way to create those bonds. At the end of 6 months, with each of the five groups, I had between a 91 to a 95% failure. That was really a shocker to me, especially when it came to the diet. I thought we would have a much better compliance. We did not. The one that surprised me is that we had over a 95% success rate, meaning people lost weight and kept it off, was the belief system. Here is the takeaway message, and I remember saying it that night. It's not that we put weight on, it's that we're frequently unconscious as to the underlying lessons of why we're putting the weight on, and how not to repeat these cycles of behavior. We're all going to make mistakes in life. In and of itself, that's not a problem. What is the lesson of our mistakes so we don't repeat it? That's the benefit of our crisis. We can learn from it if we choose to. Or we choose not to learn and we process our mistake through the very mind that created the mistake, our subconscious, in which case all we are is in defending our choice, defending our ego, defending our self with some self-righteous rage. We learn nothing. And it's the repetition that really undermines us. That was a surprise to me. But it also taught me that just giving people perfect diets or great exercise programs or all the nutrients they need, the what I call the reductionist approach to health, they want one piece of the puzzle. They want every part of that puzzle. They want to reduce it down to the simplest form as if that's going to correct all their problems. So all of us in life have one or a few pieces of the puzzle, but we don't have all the pieces. And therefore, we de-evolve to the lowest standard of truth within our own journey. Everything's a shortcut. Everything is, well, there's too much dis-ease. I want to be at ease. I want to take it easy. I don't want to get uncomfortable. And so our lack of willing to go through discipline, our lack of going through sacrifice, in effect, propels us towards an ever-increasing certainty of a bad outcome. So when I tell people, you cannot be healthy and be overweight, it's politically incorrect. Because at a time when nothing is honest, nothing, where everything is identity politics, stupid, then how in the world are you supposed to help people if the truth they need to hear, they're not willing to? But here's the reality. You cannot be healthy and be overweight. It doesn't matter how good you feel about yourself. When you're overweight, your emotions can control, well, okay, I'm going to be overweight, so I'm just going to accept myself for being overweight, and I'll buy larger clothes. And it doesn't change the fact that you're putting a strain on your body. You're increasing oxidative stress. You're increasing pressure upon your heart. You're increasing the pressure to detoxify the byproducts of your fat metabolism. You're increasing oxidative stress in the brain. You're creating inflammatory cytokines in the brain. You're going to suffer from dementia and all these other conditions more quickly. Now we can add something to this truth. There is a link between being overweight and 40% of all the cancers diagnosed in the United States. Now, this just came out yesterday morning. So that doesn't mean that every person overweight will develop cancer. There's still a lot to be known about the study. However, the study findings suggest that being overweight was associated with cancer involving more than 630,000 Americans in 1 year. That's 13 types of cancer. Quote, the overweight, obesity, or affecting cancer may be surprising to many Americans. The awareness of some cancers being associated with being overweight is not yet widespread. And here are the cancers you're more likely to have if you're overweight. Brain cancer, multiple myeloma, cancer of the esophagus, postmenopausal breast cancer, cancer of the thyroid, gallbladder, stomach, liver, pancreas, kidney, ovaries, uterus, colon. That's some of the worst. So just remember, if you're overweight, you're not healthy. Now, that doesn't mean that because you're overweight, you should feel bad about yourself. I do not believe in any form of self-deprecating negative imaging. That only compounds the problem. I believe in being a pragmatist, meaning, okay, there is a problem. Let's face it. Let's talk about it. Let's identify it. But at least let's not deny it. Let's go forward. And how can you change a problem that you're not completely honest about? You can't. So we spend too much of our time de-evolving into excuses, justifications, rationalizations to hide our responsibility. If someone's going to in any way criticize us, especially family members or friends, people who may feel there's no need for a boundary, you can say anything you want to someone that you know because they got to tolerate it, which is being hyper insensitive. The fact that you know someone intimately does not mean that you have a right to be critical of them. Words count. Negative words are extremely destructive. And they're not coming from love. So never say that you love someone and then criticize them in a way that's sharp and destructive. Then you're a hypocrite. You're an emotional punk. So all the time people say, but I love you, and then they take a knife to your emotions. They don't love anything. More often than not, these are narcissists tied into their own immature world. I just see so many adults who are such emotional babies. They are high-maintenance adults. And isn't it time we call this out for what it is? We become a nation of high-maintenance emotional people who are so immature and so filled with contempt for what they are not, so fearful of their own incompleteness and insecurities, they just project it out of everyone, at everyone else. And that's just wrong. If you really want to help someone, come from love. Not anger, not hate. So that's the takeaway message there. Now, there's a study at a University of Rochester Medical School. It says, quote, teenagers with school starting times before 8:30 a.m. may have a particular risk of experiencing depression and anxiety due to compromised sleep quality. Oh, diddums have some sleep difficulty. This is how wrong universities are today. My God, what are they missing? How about it's bedtime, I'm not sleepy. It's not important if you're sleepy. Your brain, your body needs this rest. Well, I'm not going to bed. I still got to spend the next 3 hours talking with my friends on all over the world. I've got to waste my time now and put this right up beside my brain. I got to go sleep with this cell phone on under my pillow. I've got to leave the computer on in case someone wants to reach me at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm taking some caffeine. It's 11 o'clock at night. I'm going to eat a pizza at 12 o'clock. Don't you dare say that I can't do this. After all, aren't you supposed to be my friend or my father? So there's no discipline today. Gee whiz, what could possibly go wrong when there's no discipline in young idiots? I don't know. Maybe nothing. No. Look at a nation of the most entitled punks ever in American world history. You can't go any place on the planet and find more dysfunctional and frequently emotionally detached people as we have. Not all, no, but the vast majority. So instead of saying, get your sleep, and if it requires putting down some rules and having some absolute unmitigated requirements, do so. And if your kids yell at you or scream at you, they're going to do that anyhow. Too bad. Because you could be saving the kid from an awful lot of biological and cellular damage. So now they're saying, let the kid be spoiled, do what they want to do, stay up as late as they want, because the last thing we want is them to come to school saying, it's too early. Can't we start at noon and go till 1 and then go to the mall and go shopping, go to the Pizza Hut, go get some nuggets, go get some colas? Yeah, that's what we want. And that way we'll prevent depression and anxiety. Now, that's going to depress the parents because the parents are already of a mindset talking with other parents that their kids are on designer Prozac or Ritalin or Paxil, just like the shooters that kill a lot of people, but not their kids. Their kids would never kill anyone. No? Gee whiz, why do I have a whole 41-page reference of kids that went to school and killed other kids, every one of them on psychiatric drugs? And what parent understands about their children and the teaching system is that every kid now is the disease. They're just not being diagnosed quickly enough and got on meds quickly enough. So we're over-medicating, we're under proper parenting, we're feeding junk food, we're feeding disease-creating food, we have epidemics of diabetes, epidemics of heart disease, epidemics of arthritis in young children. We have one of the highest infant mortality rates. No, we have the highest infant mortality rate in the developed world. But who's concerned? Well, I believe we should be. So, University of Rochester Medical Center, why don't you spend a little more time being a little more critical of the parenting impact on adolescent sleep and daily functioning rather than on how the kids feel about having to come to school early. By the way, let me think. When you were going to school and I was going to school, do any of you remember anyone ever in your school's history being diagnosed with ADD or given Ritalin? No, not once. How about school suicides? Never. Mm-mm. How about going to school and say, I'm depressed because I want to come later? No, didn't happen. I guess this is a new epidemic, maybe genetic. Yeah, that's what we're dealing with. We got to just be aware of it. And for those of you who don't think stress is important, New York University is showing us that stress diminishes our capacity to sense new dangers. Being under stress diminishes our abilities to predict new dangers that we face. And this work runs counter to the conventional view that stress enhances our ability to detect and adjust to these changing sources of threat. Quote, stress does not always increase perceptions of dangers in the environment, as it often is assumed. In fact, our study shows that when we're under stress, we pay less attention to changes in the environment, potentially putting us at greater increased risk for ignoring new sources of threat. As a result, stress can reduce the flexibility of our responses to threats by impairing how well we track and update predictions of potentially dangerous circumstances. End quote. Boy, this couldn't be any more timely. We're looking at an industry, multiple industries, but mainly the tourist industry, on all the joy myself and many of you have had going to wonderful countries, engaging in the cultures. And then there's the tourist industry. You don't learn a thing about the cultures. You only see those people who are allowed from the local culture, the local native population, into the compounds, always guarded by guns and security. They're there to, in effect, act as your servants. You have unlimited alcohol and food and beautiful beaches and bungalows and dancing. So for you, the tourist, you're enjoying only one out-of-context part of a culture. But what if you went to a place not to go to the beaches and the resorts, but rather to go inland and spend your week or 10 days visiting the people who live there and see how do they live, how do they survive, how do they eat, how they spend their times, what gives them joy, the significance of their lives, their families, their friends, their philosophies, their notion of history, and ask them, how do you feel about these multi-million dollar resorts being built, but not one penny is spent on new homes, urban gardens, community marketplaces? Nothing for you. No new sewer systems, no new water purification systems, no new roads to where you're at, but new roads, except in Jamaica. Jamaica's a basket case. I will never forget being in a car with the Ministry of Health's deputy driving me to a place, and I said, aren't you going to slow down? You see, there's a bus coming. Oh, we in Jamaica have learned how to almost wreck. Almost wreck, meaning you're like a half an inch away from each other going on around curves. I said, why don't you widen the roads? Nope. Person's very, calm about it. That's not where we put our money. They put their money where the industry wants it. Sugarcane production, yes. Molasses production, yes. Tourism, yes. But the road that takes you to the Montego Bay, to the resorts, no. To the landscaping, passing junkyards and decaying homes, why don't you go in here and take the 1,000 acres and build a beautiful village and allow the local inhabitants to work with local architects and local artists to design what they want, what they feel, here's what our houses should look like. Here's how many bedrooms we should have. Here's what our view should be. Shouldn't we also be able to overlook the ocean? Shouldn't we have playgrounds? And shouldn't we have, why not do that for the people? That's not how it works down here. You mean not a single place, not in the place that's now filled with organized crime, the 10%ers, the mobs, the drug cartels are in all over South America and Central America. They're sending in their own lawyers and to buy people's property for pennies on the dollar and giving you a choice. Today, you sign the contract. We're going to buy your property for 10% of its value. We're going to give you silver. If you say no, tomorrow someone's going to pack and give you lead in your head. And they don't joke. They don't bluff. And so these are now new safe houses. These are places of washing illicit money into clean money. Now they got all this real estate, and it was legally purchased. Try to complain. They own the judges. They own the police. They own everything. And it's also true to one of the most beautiful tropical forests, eco forests in the world, Costa Rica, utterly corrupt. In any case, so listen what I'm saying. Every place, there's no exception here. Not one island is exempt from nature's capacity to bring to it a message. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time. You have no support system. You have no good management. And that's not going to change. But we're going to increase the frequency of our storms. And when you see 95% of the inhabitants' homes destroyed, there's no insurance. There's not going to be money to rebuild these places. But when the cameras stop and the interest goes elsewhere, those people will be living in rubble. In Puerto Rico, you got 3.4 million people. There's electricity to only a small percentage of the island. The infrastructure is destroyed. Everything has been given now, from emergency water to medical supplies to food, is not sustainable. Just imagine that you're hit in a storm and you have to go live in a Red Cross shelter that is now an old hockey rink. True story. This actually happened in between Fort Myers and Naples. There's the hockey rink, and that was converted into an emergency shelter. But let's say for the next year you can't leave that shelter, and the only food you've got are food that comes in these little stupid dry packages, and anything the Red Cross is going to give you is crap. The Red Cross should cease to exist. They should take that organization down, replace it with one that actually puts 95% of all the money they get back into the people. And I will do a different show one day about how much money they squander for themselves. But in any case, so the entire Caribbean now does not have a future. The tourism industry does not have a future because the tourist industry has to have 95% of its staff or more come from local populations that don't have homes, don't have water, don't have electricity, and whatever's put in its place is going to be worse than what was there before. And what was there before was no better than a penal colony conditions. So, want to look where you're not going to have any sustainable future? The entire Caribbean, all the islands, their history. So, just imagine then, when you're under stress, and you should be able to predict dangers because you're made aware that there's a problem, now you go into a cognitive disconnect and denialism. I'm one person. I can't stop Mother Nature. It's getting worse. There are 22 volcanoes going off right now as we speak today on the Pacific Rim. 22 volcanoes and 3 in Africa. In any case, we're having enormously negative impact and one of the worst storms in United Kingdom history is going on. And Norway, the entire coastal area is flooding. I just posted some photographs this morning up on my personal Gary Nall Facebook of one-time beautiful communities in Norway. They're all flooded. I mean, they didn't have the destructive hurricane force winds, but the waters came up so high, just flooded out streets, homes, destroying them. They weren't prepared for it. Now, you think if you're seeing storms around the world and you're on the water close to it, maybe you should realize the water is rising worldwide. Remember, there is no Pacific Ocean, Indian Ocean, Arctic Ocean. There isn't, that doesn't exist. That is a myth. There's only one body of water, period. There's only one body. I'm just amazed at how dumb they think we are, that we somehow think, well, what happened in the Pacific Ocean is different than the Gulf of Mexico. Why should it be? Only one body of water. It's just gravitational pull will determine some areas get a little more water on their surge. So now Norway, all those beautiful places that people thought were the most coveted places to live in Norway, underwater today, as I speak, underwater. So that means that now we think we can't change. We don't have the money. Insurance companies, which are the complete criminal rackets, because they want to get as much money as they can out of you in premiums and do everything they can to prevent that money from going back out to cover your losses. Every insurance company is this way. They all are liars. They're thieves. I don't respect a single insurance company. I sure as hell do not respect Warren Buffett and the companies he owns, but that shouldn't surprise anybody. He'll continue to be the most respected businessman in the world. Just look at where he makes his money. So heads up, when now you're under stress, you deny your vulnerability or you take a fatalistic approach. Well, I don't want to move because I invested so much. I don't want to move because I've been here so long. Well, it won't happen again, will it? Yeah, it's going to happen again. And our government has not been prepared once. And yet the buffoons in the White House keep saying, great job, great job. This is an embarrassment. A great job would have been to have put maybe $50 to $100 billion in rebuilding the entire infrastructure of Puerto Rico with industries that would not have been affected by hurricanes, by making them water self-sufficient with desalinization plans, by giving them natural grid solar for the whole island, that would have given them also living communities that were not at the water's edge, so that when a storm hit, they would still be able to have quality of life, water productivity, and they've done none of the above. And they're not going to pay off these debts for these people. So you're going to have to find some place for 3.4 million people to live. All of them can't move. The younger ones will. And then the opportunists will take advantage, the vulture capitalists, of what's left. So be realistic, because we're in cognitive disconnect. We are not going to change any of our habits. We're not going to change our buying habits, consumption habits, living habits, because of how bad it is in different places. That's the reality. We didn't do it after Katrina. We didn't do it after Sandy. We're not doing it after these or the next. The only time we will finally decide to do something is when a major city is hit so hard that it disrupts the entire economy, like New York or Washington, Miami, Los Angeles. Then and only then will we galvanize our resources, which are formidable, to say, should we be helping people move out of these areas? And the answer is yes. And how are we going to do that without collapsing the tax base that then would collapse all of our social services and turn every one of these major cities into ghettos? And that's where you have to be a lot more creative than you have in the past, and you can't let all the same people who've been controlling, you know, Milton Friedman, bunch of punks, they're all just a bunch of punks over at the University of Chicago School of Economics, because they're all not just believing, they're indoctrinated into the neoliberal globalist agenda of make money and never concern yourself with the consequences. The ends are always first. The means to those ends can always be forgiven. Big mistake. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Oh, well, I'm sitting here la la waiting for my ya-ya. Oh, I'm sitting here la la waiting for my ya-ya. Oh, it may sound funny, but I don't believe she's coming. Oh, me worry.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall, dealing with issues that are not always easy to hear, but are important that we have an opportunity to know the truth, that there is no group rescuing us. There's no place of wise men and women making moral and ethical decisions on our behalf. It does not exist anywhere on the planet. That we have been betrayed by every single institution, every paradigm, and its leaders, and that we're on our own. Now, in and of itself, that's a good thing, because if I know you're not my friend, if I know you don't have my back, if I know that you are capable of betraying me, using me, lying to me, and manipulating me, why in the world would I want to be a part of you? So, I then free myself to meet with those people who are of a positive mind, who are living at a higher level of vibration, a higher level of consciousness, and then work together. The we working together can find solutions, because we're not in denial of the problem. So I don't see anything that is happening to us as an irreversible, catastrophic negative. I see them as painful lessons, but I'd rather learn from a painful lesson than to be oblivious and have it reoccur again, just like the second heart attack. If you're finally aware of what caused your first one and you don't change anything, the second one, which will more often than not be fatal, shouldn't come as a surprise. What should come as a surprise is that many of the so-called liberal community have supported regime change. They did not condemn, but rather supported Gaddafi's regime change. And the same with Syria and Assad. They fell right into the same thing that they rightly condemned in let's say, the invasion of Iraq in 2003. They said that the weapons of mass destruction didn't exist. They would frequently have on guests that would support that they didn't exist. But why would they then be complicit here? But they were. But then these same people who were supporting regime change, which is fascistic, in Syria and Libya, then supported the White Helmets. The White Helmets are a terrorist organization, but the media praised them, calls them heroes. And yesterday we played part one, today we're finishing it with part two, of an independent journalist group that went into Aleppo, East Aleppo, where the White Helmets were, and tell you the truth of what they found from the citizens who survived. And let's see if the media, including those apologists for the White Helmets or defenders of them and the defenders of the regime change in Libya and Syria, if they're willing to say, you know, we made a mistake. Here's part two.
Washington barred the leader of the White Helmets from entering the United States, allegedly for his ties to jihadists. Still, they have no problem sending millions to his organization.
We provide through USAID about $23 million in assistance to them.
Why is the U.S. taxpayer supporting a group whose leader you have banned from coming to the States?
Why indeed, considering that their actions were clearly disputed by the International Civil Defense Organization in Geneva?
The White Helmets are not even civil defense concretely. We are working in the field and only with official governments, not the White Helmets.
Yet they do operate in rebel and jihadist territories.
White Helmets cannot be independent. Any NGO cannot be independent, because independent people, meaning he can take decision, and nobody there can take decision except Al-Nusra.
They claim neutrality. But given their track record, it would be near impossible to call them neutral.
All of the countries that are backing, promoting, and funding the White Helmets and were involved in the creation of the White Helmets are countries that are also have a vested interest in the destabilization of Syria and the removal of the legitimate and elected President Assad.
The White Helmets were founded by a former British intelligence agent turned mercenary. He trained them in Turkey, teaching them rescue and photography skills, and more. No other first responders in the world are as social media savvy as them, or as widely financed.
They are funded $23 million by the United States via the US Aid Agency and via its various outreach agents. The UK Foreign Office is the primary driver behind the White Helmets and has put in, we believe to date, around between 40 and 65 million pounds from the Conflict Stability and Security Fund into the White Helmets. We then have smaller donations or funding figures for the White Helmets from, for example, Holland, Germany, Denmark. France is supplying equipment as well as financing the White Helmets.
One of the driving forces behind the White Helmets' PR machine is the Syria campaign. It also claims to be, quote, fiercely independent, though its long track record of activism tells a different story. It once boasted of pressuring the UN into replacing its coordinator in Syria for being too friendly with Assad, though that boast was later retracted. It was first financed by Ayman Asfari, a Syrian billionaire living in Britain, whose wife co-chairs the organization. He himself also funded the Syrian National Council, the rebel government in exile, which has little sway in Syria itself. Asfari is known to be a representative of Syrian anti-Assad groups. In that capacity, he has visited the White House no less than 8 times in recent years.
Ayman Asfari is a Syrian national, an oil tycoon who has put large sums of money of funding into the Tory government in the UK. He's currently undergoing a serious fraud office investigation, and he has a very clear vested interest, oil interests, particularly with BP. He's the CEO of Petrofac, but serious oil interests inside Syria, and he is the one behind the Syria campaign. The Syria campaign is running the publicity campaign for the White Helmets. And the Hero Fund was set up by the Syria campaign to basically draw in public funding for this organization.
So, funded by an anti-Assad billionaire in 2014, the Syrian campaign was hiring staff for, quote, pieces in the US, UK, and European media markets. Knowledge of Syria or Arabic being non-essential. What was needed was an ability to, quote, spot media opportunities by the hour and make things happen. Well, one thing that happened was the story of little Omran.
What strikes me is we shed tears, but there are no tears here. He doesn't cry once.
May I show you a picture? This young boy has become the symbol of the war.
Omran, the boy who became the face of the Battle of Aleppo and an icon of the White Helmets. It is still unclear how an Australian journalist got the images, considering a communications blackout in Aleppo. But it was the Syria campaign that organized interviews with the photographers behind the story and was singled out, credited for activism.
Were you horrified by the footage of little Omran? Can't stop thinking about him? Well, don't just retweet. Be outraged for 24 hours and move on. Hear what two great humanitarians for Syria, Zaher Salul and James Sadri, want you to do now.
It was only later we found out that Omran was being used.
They started filming him while I was in the house. I came out and asked, where are the kids? They told me they were at the hospital. They took me with the ambulance. Omran's head was bandaged. Nevertheless, they took him to the hospital just to film him. I was busy saving my family, and they seized the opportunity and filmed my family while they were getting out of the house for the sake of propaganda.
It is a recurring theme with the White Helmets. Backed by the powers that be, funded to the tune of hundreds of millions, and blessed with near unanimous media sympathy. Yet, Dig just a little under the surface, and the selfless rescuer facade seems to crumble in on itself. Murad Gazdiev, RT, from Aleppo, Syria.
Okay, so there you have it. The White Helmets, from the very beginning, has been a U.S. CIA, National Security Agency group. They are terrorists supporting Al-Qaeda, and yet all of our mainstream media and much of our alternative media supported them. Now you know the truth. So why is it that with all of the capacity of journalists, the resources, are they intentionally censoring, or have they been propagandized to a point where they may actually believe their own lies? Now you're going to hear from a professor of psychology, University of California, give one of the most brilliant descriptions of how we become brainwashed or propagandized. It'll be in three parts, or four parts. This is part one.
So my name is Jerry Croft. I'm a professor, a psych prof in California. And this talk is about propaganda. And I would like the psychology of propaganda. And I'd like you to look at a set of photographs. This is from the 50s. And just store your emotional reactions. What are your emotional reactions to what you see? Why we have the youngest customers in the business. Nothing does it like 7-Up. Coca-Cola was not to be outdone. For a better start in life, start cola earlier. How soon is too soon? And here's Santa Claus urging you to give cigarettes, Lucky Strikes, to your friends for Christmas. And there's a doctor who, in the small print, it says he works hard and you can trust him. And more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. That's pretty close to a recommendation, isn't it? And don't worry, darling, you didn't burn the beer. At least you can drink Schlitz when your wife can't even cook. Oh, and down at the bottom, you mean a woman can open up a bottle of ketchup? Wow, how did they get so smart? So you think that in the past, oh my God, people were living in a trance. They were brainwashed. I mean, here you're giving poisons to your friends for Christmas. Doctors are recommending that you ingest something in your lungs that causes lung cancer. Women are demeaned. There's no sense of emancipation of women at all. And they're giving sugar water. This has over 10 teaspoons of sugar to a little four-month-old baby. And you think, my God, those people were crazy. Well, the purpose of today's talk is a controversial idea that we are just as much in a trance and hypnotized by the media as the generation of our parents and grandparents who watched those Mad Men commercials. Things are not any better for us. We are not more liberated and more aware of the world. We're just as much victimized by it. So this talk comes from a book I wrote called Duped: Delusion, Denial, and the End of the American Dream. Now, all the references for this talk are in that book, so I'm not going to give you references here. But let's talk about some statistics about our current lives. Kids spend currently 45 hours per week in screen time. That means TV, internet, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. That's a lot of time. The average American now spends 9 hours per day using the media. 50% of American children from 8 to 18 report that the TV is on in their home constantly. So we are really glued to... some people say outside of sleep, work, that's the majority of what we do, screen time. We're glued to our screens. So the question is, are we getting dumber? For example, over 90% of fourth graders could not identify a photograph of Abraham Lincoln. Not too impressive. 75% of 17-year-olds could not identify who was the head of Germany in World War II. 30% of high school students did not know how long it took the Earth to orbit the sun. Half of U.S. fourth graders did not know the meaning of the word puzzle. So you can say, well, the media is really dumbing people down and we're getting less and less educated. But I'd like to give you a contrary position, okay? 75% of 17-year-olds knew what city was in the zip code 90210. Well, that's pretty good. That's pretty smart, isn't it? They know what city that zip code is in. Now, they know that because there was a television program called 90210. But they've 96% of American school children can identify Ronald McDonald. It's as if we're living in a playhouse, which is the media-created fantasy world that we spend 9 hours a day doing. And we know everything about that playhouse. We know who Kim Kardashian is, but we don't know who Scott Carpenter is. We've substituted our fantasy reality for real reality, if you want to put it that way. So I'm not so sure we are dumbing down as much as the fact that we are living increasingly in the trance without knowing it. So what are the propaganda tools that we're going to talk about that keep us in this fog? Reframing, repeated affirmations, vicarious and imitative learning, distraction and denial, classical and operant conditioning. So get ready, because we're now engaged in the process of media literacy, which means we're pulling off the veil of propaganda and clearing out the fog and starting to see what's really going on with the mass media and us and our consciousness. I'm going to start with the easiest one first, reframing, okay? In 1984, George Orwell writes a book called 1984, and there's a whole propaganda ministry in his fictional book that writes propaganda and that rewrites, makes bad things sound good, makes garbage smell like perfume with the right language. And the language was called newspeak, okay? So here, and it's basically reframing, putting new, nice words on bad things. George Bush was not the greatest environmental president of American history. He allowed, he cut gasoline mileage requirements. He cut rules and regulations on diesel emissions. He weakened rules protecting rivers from pollution. He allowed more nitrogen oxide, mercury, and sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere. So if we went to a guy and said, how do you feel about more sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere? Guy on the street says, well, I don't think that's very good. I think that isn't that called smog? Well, what do you think about more mercury in the atmosphere? Well, I think that's bad for your brain, isn't it? I don't think I support that. Okay, so we're going to, what is the name for the legislation that George Bush introduced that weakened all of these regulations? Well, here comes newspeak. It was called the Clear Skies Act and the Clean Water Act. Really? Really? Well, how do you feel about the Clear Skies Act? Oh, I think I like clear skies. I would support that. How do you feel about the Clean Water Act? I'm definitely in favor of clean water. Absolutely. Okay. So there's reframing for you. It gets worse. In the last 20 years, 55,000 American factories have closed, fired their workers, moved to China, to Vietnam, to Indonesia, to the Dominican Republic. They say that 6 million jobs were permanently lost due to this process. Chinese workers make our toys and make virtually everything sold in Walmart, and they get paid $3 an hour. In Bangladesh, women are making clothes that are sold in Target and JCPenney. They earn $36 a month. That's about 25 cents an hour for that shirt that you bought at JCPenney. Now, Detroit is a very good example of this process. We don't have a name for it yet. In Detroit, in 1960, Detroit was an incredibly vibrant city. They had 290,000 manufacturing jobs. Today, there are 27,000 manufacturing jobs. 90% of the manufacturing jobs left Detroit. That's a picture of the General Motors building, okay? Empty, windows broken, all right? But there's a brand new Ford factory, state-of-the-art, beautiful, makes 250,000 Ford Focuses every year. But guess where it's located? It's located in Hermosillo, Mexico. And they make 250,000 Fords there and send them to the United States duty-free. Detroiters don't like that. The average wage paid to those workers in that factory is $3 an hour. Now, I ask audiences, how many of you have ever worked for $3 an hour? Most everybody doesn't even raise their hand. Senior citizens will say, I once worked for $3 an hour in the 1950s. Well, this is 2013, and that's where Fords are made today. And the result is, it's not that General Motors was making gas guzzlers. It's partly true, but 90% of Detroit's good jobs left. And Detroit closed 50% of its schools, okay? It currently is in bankruptcy. That's a picture of a great, famous Detroit movie theater. Frank Sinatra played there once. So what do you call this? Detroiters don't like what happened, okay? But this is the name given for this process. It's called globalization, and it's called free trade. So what do you think about globalization? Oh, I think I like globalization. That sounds modern. That sounds international. I think I support globalization. How do you feel about free trade? Oh, I'm in favor of free trade. I like anything that's free, you know? I think that's a good thing. And so bad things are made to sound sweet and nice with reframing. Here's a little video on this subject.
Now we're going to end part one. There'll be four other parts to this about how we become programmed. And everyone has a different motivation for programming us, to wanting us to believe them and only them. And you'll better understand how vulnerable we all are, no matter the politics or our culture, beliefs, to heavy-duty programming. I'm Gary Nall. That brings us up to the end of this program, and I want to thank you all for taking your time and sharing with us today. Have a nice day, everyone.
When the night has come and the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see.